From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Florida's roads are among the deadliest in the nation when it comes to accidents. That's especially true when they involve pedestrians and bicyclists. And Southwest Florida ranks among the most dangerous areas in the entire state. Ahead of a regional transportation summit next week, we're taking a look at current efforts to make our roads safer, how changes to our roadways happen, and what the long-term goals are for those looking to make Florida's roads safe for cyclists, pedestrians, and motorists. Plus, it's been a rough season for Florida's tomato growers. One of the wettest winters in decades gave way to a growing season marked by disease and a nearly 23% reduction in crop yields compared to the previous growing season. Following the 41st annual Joint Tomato Conference in Naples earlier this month, a closer look at the status of the industry and projections for the upcoming growing season. First, this news. From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Tomato growers in Florida are reeling from a rotten year. After one of the wettest winters in decades, disease and low yields led to a nearly 23% drop in output for growers. Following the 41st annual Joint Tomato Conference in Naples earlier this month, we'll explore the status of the state's tomato industry and projections for the coming growing season. But first, Florida's roads are among the deadliest in the country. It's a problem that affects motorists, bicyclists, pedestrians, and everyone who uses our roads. In Lee County alone, just one health care provider, Lee Memorial Health System, says they treated more than 200 bicycle and pedestrian injuries last year, an increase of 6%. On average, those injuries required 6 days in the hospital, and more than 7% of those victims died from their injuries. Ahead of a regional transportation summit next week, we're talking to transportation experts and advocates about how our roads have become so dangerous, what's being done to make the roads safer, and the changes advocates want to see. My guests today are Don Scott. He's executive director of the Lee County Metropolitan Planning Organization. That organization is responsible for determining how to use state and federal transportation dollars in Lee County, prioritizing transportation projects, and maintaining the county's 5-year transportation improvement program. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Also joining us is Tess Lesage, the Director of Social Innovation and Sustainability at the Southwest Florida Community Foundation. In the past, she was a planner for Lee County and helped implement the Complete Streets Policy, a $10 million project to enhance biker and pedestrian safety and connectivity. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We also have Ann Pierce with the nonprofit Streets Alive Southwest Florida. She's worked with advocacy groups in our area on biking and open streets events. She's one of the organizers behind the Transportation Summit going on next week at the Cape Coral Yacht Club. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you very much.
And joining us on the phone is Ian Lockwood, a transportation engineer based out of Orlando. He's worked on infrastructure and planning projects across North America for more than 30 years, covering everything from complete streets projects to traffic calming to urban revitalization. Thanks for your time today as well. So, Ian, do we have you on the phone? Well, we'll check back.
I'm here.
Oh, great. We hear you now. Great. And we're talking transportation today on Gulf Coast Live, the current systems that make South Florida's streets some of the most dangerous in the country, as well as plans and proposals to make our streets safer for everyone using the road. Join the conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Reach out on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, or tweet your ideas. We're at WGCU. Use the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And let's start with a basic question about our current transportation system, the one that our national and statewide statistics say is resulting in a growing number of deaths each year. Don, you're with the Lee County MPO. Your organization decides priorities for transportation projects and how state and federal transportation dollars are spent. What is it about our roads that are so deadly? How do you measure what's working and what's not?
Well, it's a combination of things. And obviously, when you start looking at the types of crashes we have and look back at the causes, unfortunately, right now, DUIs and distracted driving is a large portion of that. If we could get rid of that, we would make a big dent in that. But even from we're spread out, we have long trip lengths. For a while, our vehicle miles traveled, how many vehicles were on the road were going down. But now we're back in the rise again, so there's more people driving, and you start combining all those issues together. And we have some infrastructure issues in certain ways too. We're trying to build more sidewalks and pathways and bike lanes and stuff, But there's also funding issues when you start trying to address that too.
Sure, sure. Limited dollars for a lot of different needs out there, I'm sure.
Right.
And Anne, as someone who's been involved in advocacy groups pushing for safer roads and for more room for bikers and pedestrians on those roads, what do you see on the streets here in Southwest Florida? You know, there's videos online. We were talking just a moment before the show began about, you know, some real abuse of folks on bicycles using our roads. Have you experienced this yourself?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I used to ride my bike regularly to and from work before I moved to Florida. And I really am not a regular bicyclist here in Florida other than participating in Critical Mass. And that's a large group. It's very visible. We take the entire lane. It's a safer environment for me to ride, but it's very dangerous to ride down here, I believe.
What other issues do you see for bikers and pedestrians here in Southwest Florida? I guess maybe that would relate more to – well, go ahead.
Lack of overall planning for that as a – for those as viable choices for transportation. They're seen as alternatives or add-ons or just something that you do for leisure or recreation. They're not seen as transportation. Walking is the primary mode of transportation. Bicycling is transportation all over the world. It was transportation here in the United States for a long time and still is in many parts of the country. These are parts of our transportation system. They need to be integrated in the network and planning.
All right. And Tessa, your work with the Southwest Florida Community Foundation is focused on broader sustainability efforts in our area. You say users have highlighted sustainability goals to include transportation and compact and complete communities. You know, hearing what's been said about our current system, what ways can we address these issues, both in changing what we have when it comes to building new roads and developments in other spaces?
From a sustainable community perspective, I would say that the best way to address it is for partners to come together around these issues and figure out a way to work together and to make them a priority. Transportation choices, it's an economic development issue. It's an access issue. It's an equity issue. We have issues with our education and with finding a job and everything else. All of that starts with transportation and your ability to access it. So I think the variety of partners that actually, when they think about it, should care about this, are really what can help, you know, take some of the onus off of just Don and the MPO and the right. transportation folks. It has to become a priority of the community. And the Community Foundation views this as an issue. When we're funding projects, we are asking folks, how do you plan to overcome transportation barriers to ensure people can get to your services? And also trying to bring people together so that we can really address these core issues.
I mean, would you say, at least here in Southwest Florida, our communities tend to, I mean, maybe just out of necessity, sort of embrace a culture where, you know, anything besides a car isn't really considered a viable means of getting from point A to point B?
So we're a post-World War II community, and it's auto-oriented design, and it's really tough to put the toothpaste back in the tube once you've started with this type of design. It's not impossible, though. And so I think no one's saying that we don't want cars. I've never heard anyone say that. I think it's more about making other forms of transportation a viable option so that there are choices and so that there are options for people who can't afford a vehicle.
All right. And Ian, joining us by phone, you've looked at these issues across the country and elsewhere in Florida. Can you tell us about the larger impacts the status quo transportation system has over a larger time frame, economically, environmentally, and beyond? And what else should we be considering and measuring to determine the effectiveness of a transportation system?
Well, I think following the Second World War, the focus has been about the car and accommodating the car and getting places more quickly. And I think we've had enough experience with that that we've noticed it's had some really negative health outcomes, environmental outcomes, cost outcomes, and our ability to maintain the system. I suspect that around the country, the toughest area is on the arterial road. These are the bigger streets that people use to get places, and that's where our jobs and grocery stores and restaurants and services are concentrated on, and that's where our transit is. And so there's a lot of people walking to across these arterial roads to get to all these different things. And those streets are designed primarily for cars, and it's there's no coincidence that people on bikes and walking are getting injured and killed on those streets. But I think all those streets typically meet the standards, but I don't think meeting standards and being safe are the same thing. And so I think there's a lot of attention being paid to ideas like complete streets and retrofitting these arterials so that they're more inclusive of all the different people who use the arterials.
All right. And, you know, also important to any discussion about a single-occupant car culture is the issue of cost. You know, according to AAA, the average cost of driving a car in 2016 is $8,500 a year, you know, with gas, insurance, maintenance. And, you know, that's more than $700 a month for a car. What other costs should we consider when we're talking about the costs of car culture, I guess?
Well, there's lots of answers to that. There's just one cost to the individual, you know, to own a car and so forth, but there's incredible costs to society to maintain the infrastructure. And our ratio of infrastructure per capita is very, very high, and there's just no way that we're being able to maintain our infrastructure in its current configuration. So we have to find more cost-effective ways to get around, and walking and cycling and transit are very cost-effective. And then there's the external costs of the car. You know, there's 30-plus thousand people a year getting killed and hundreds of thousands of people getting injured every year. So there's giant health care and societal costs to the car, you know, not to mention all the environmental consequences. So the costs are actually enormous for our car culture.
And Tessa, I saw you kind of, you know, shaking your head in acknowledgement there. Was there anything you wanted to add to that? Or
actually, I was checking off all of the boxes in my head as he talked. He did a great job. I'm glad he threw environment there at the end.
Absolutely.
So.
Anne, yes.
The other cost that's often overlooked and that we hope to address at this summit is the cost of chronic diseases that evolved and are associated with sedentary lifestyle. Sedentary lifestyle is associated with automobile dependency, and the number of chronic diseases is enormous. I mean, more than a dozen. And it's been estimated by the CDC that we, the American taxpayer, will be bearing a burden somewhere close to $500 billion for those diseases directly stemming from sedentary lifestyle. Another thing about cost infrastructure, you know, when Don has his budget, or the local DOTs or public work departments, those are capital costs for infrastructure. But more than 60% of the total cost of any roadway is going to be in operation and maintenance. Those numbers don't show up in the CIP, but they have to be paid. And this is what Ian was referring to in terms of the future burden for our society and trying to maintain all this pavement.
All right. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. Listeners can call in and join the discussion about Southwest Florida's transportation needs and what problems you think are most in need of being fixed. Call in to 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Reach us on Facebook, post a comment on our page at WGCU Public Media, and tweet your thoughts at WGCU using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And next week, the nonprofit Streets Alive Southwest Florida is holding a transportation summit in Cape Coral at the Cape Coral Yacht Club. Its focus is on safe and accessible transportation for all road users. You're helping to organize the summit. You've advocated for a multimodal transportation system. Can you explain what that is and what changes we could expect if such a system were implemented here? And, you know, maybe what other ideas will be on the table at this summit?
Well, a multimodal system would be one where there is connectivity, where you can get from here to there via a number of choices, walking or bicycling or transit. For example, I'd love to take the bus to the airport when I go on a trip instead of having to drive my car and it just sits there for days. I lived and worked in Washington, D.C., and when I left, you know, I walked out the door, locked the door, and depending on the weather and the time and the weight that I might be carrying that morning, I had five different choices on how to get to work, and none of them involved owning a car of my own. That's freedom of choice, and that's what we could have here.
All right. And, you know, Tessa, I want to kind of – you've touched on this a little bit, but just going back to the term sustainable when we're talking about development, what does that mean for people who are, you know, just perfectly happy with the system as is? Does sustainable mean, you know, maybe giving up their car?
Absolutely not. I think that sustainable means a lot of things to a lot of – to different people. But I bet that people who are perfectly happy with their car sit there and wish that they're – could get through that light quicker or could avoid that turn lane. And the reality is that there are a number of people that would choose to take their car off the road, at least for some trips, if not for all, if they had the opportunity to do so, if they could do the things that they needed to do in an efficient amount of time and safely.
Hmm. Well, you know, let's focus on an issue that, you know, we have touched on here, but it can sometimes be overlooked when we discuss these large overhauls of systems like transportation, and that is, of course, cost. Don, with the Metropolitan Planning Organization, you know, you guys rely on gas taxes to fund a lot of the operations there. But with more hybrids and electric cars on the road and more fuel-efficient vehicles, lower gas prices, is it possible to address these issues and bring about the changes being called for? Or, you know, do we need to look at other funding sources?
I think no matter what, if there's not even any changes, we have to look at other ways to fund this system in the future, let alone maintain it. When you start talking about even though our vehicle miles travel is going up, the gas tax is kind of flat, and what you're touching on, they're getting more fuel efficient, and that is the primary state and federal funding that's used for roads and maintenance of the facilities, and along with the other things we're talking about, bike ped features and funding transit too.
All right. Well, we have this tweet from at Calusa Water. They write to us, how do we mesh growth with watershed planning? Impairment occurs when impervious surface less than 10%. I'm not entirely certain there, but I mean, I think that gets into the cost of maintaining roads. But is that something that comes into this planning as well, looking at these environmental concerns?
Well, obviously, when we add more impervious, we need to treat that. And that's a big focus for a lot of things that are brought up, because the more you add, the more storage you need and the more retention and treatment of it before it goes out to the river or wherever.
All right. And let's take a call from Don in Naples. Don, welcome to Gulf. Oh, no, not right there now. But his comment, I think, related to the question I was just about to ask Ian about, because this caller was, I think, referring to a trip he'd recently taken to Oregon. But Ian, if you have experience with other parts of the state and the country, you know, how have other cities adapted to pay for these kind of large-scale overhauls to transportation infrastructure? Have other Florida cities been successful in making these changes?
Well, it's interesting. There's this sort of assumption out there that as cities are to grow their populations, they have to build you know, wider roads and have more traffic. But the best cities in the world are growing both their populations and their economies, and they're lowering the amount of traffic. And that's because of what and that's what we're talking about, was providing choices. And interestingly, from a cost perspective, accommodating most trips by car is the most cost expensive way of providing transportation ever invented. And the cities that provide choices actually can spend a smaller proportion of their city wealth on getting around. So, for example, Toronto spends about half as much of its wealth as Houston does just to get around, because Houston has a very car-dependent system and Toronto doesn't. And Copenhagen, who has fantastic bike facilities and walking facilities, they even spend a smaller proportion of their city wealth on getting around. So if we want to keep our taxes down and make it affordable in the future, you know, providing these much, much, much more affordable transportation options makes a lot of sense.
Interesting. Anne, yes.
I'd like to speak to that also. Just as by way of example, in Colorado, where I lived for 20 years, there was a notoriously congested highway between Boulder and Denver, Route 36. So it had to be rebuilt and renovated, and when they did it, they did it for all modes. They have a 12-foot bike lane, multi-use lane, both sides. They have dedicated rapid bus or bus express lanes in both directions. And then they have the four travel lanes for regular vehicles. But what they're doing by putting all of those modes on one road is moving many, many more individuals, humans, and many fewer vehicles. And that's the point is to move people, and connect them to what they need and they want for their daily needs and for the quality of life, not to move little boxes of steel necessarily.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back just a minute to something that Ian had said, you know, talking about cities like Copenhagen as an example. And, you know, Tess, very early in the program, you'd talked about, you know, this being a post-World War II development. You know, when you compare us to, you know, much longer established cities, places like Copenhagen and a lot of European cities that, you know, were designed before cars, do they maybe just have an easier time making these kind of infrastructure changes?
No. I often hear one of the problems in Florida is that Florida built out during the sprawl, the height of sprawl in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so did Colorado. The distances of travel are much further there. They're equally spread out. You have blizzards. You have elk who jump in front of cars. You have black ice. You have all kinds of problems there for driving that you do not have here. Yet their safety record is far better than Florida, and they have managed to embrace multimodalism. It's a decision. It's a decision made at the government level and made at the level of citizenry.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and take that call now from Don in Naples, since we've got you on the line. Well, let's see.
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Oh, great, great. Go ahead.
This is just a comment. I was in Oregon in the West Coast last year, and it was very obvious when I was there how extremely conscious powered vehicle drivers were, people in cars and trucks and things like that, were of bicycles on the roadway, especially in a large city like Portland. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call, Don. And this is something that we touched on again before the show and a little bit earlier. What do we do to combat this kind of anti-cyclist culture that, I mean, I know it's not everyone, but we, you know, anybody who's biked around here in Lee County, almost anyone you talk to is going to have some kind of story.
Your leaders have to lead on it, I would say, is the first step.
There has to be a combination of things that happen. One is education about what the laws really are.
Mm-hmm.
The second piece is design issues. I mean, like the way you design the road, if you reduce a speed limit on a road that's designed to drive 45 miles an hour to make it safer for people to ride their bike or walk, people are still probably going to drive to the speed that the road was designed for.
Mm-hmm.
And then also enforcement. I mean, it has to become unacceptable to treat other modes of transportation as if they're not, you know, as equal as the vehicle.
Gotcha. And Tessa, you know, going back to the issue of cost for some of these infrastructure changes, how do private partners and others chip in for that?
You know, I think the thing that we haven't necessarily touched on here that is really key,
uh-huh,
to the transportation system and sort of shifting it to something that's more multimodal is the surrounding context of the roads. So there are roads that should be roads for higher speeds and moving fast and trucks and those sorts of things, because economic development and our ability to have jobs and a strong economy are incredibly important. But then there are parts of Southwest Florida where the context should adapt to pedestrians, to people riding their bicycles, to public transportation. And I think that the investment that it takes in infrastructure could be highly supported by private development if the policies that are in place make it really easy for them to do something that's more compact, to do something that's truly mixed use, that's walkable, that's at a pedestrian scale. But it has to be a partnership, because if it's harder to do infill and to build that sort of design, which is not the typical design here in Southwest Florida, then no one's ever going to do it. So it really has to be a very good dynamic conversation between public and private to understand what it's going to take in order to create the context in the right places for this type of multimodal transportation system.
All right. And looking a bit into the future now, at some of the larger trends and larger projects, where does public transportation come into this conversation?
Well, obviously it's out there. One of the issues we have, though, is expanding it from what it is right now. Mm-hmm. There are some communities, too. They're kind of tying Uber with transit to try to do the end trips, essentially, to get you to the transit routes. But unfortunately, from a funding thing right now, what you see out there is pretty much what we have in the future at the moment.
Okay. I mean, do you think some of these innovations, like you mentioned, like Uber and Lyft and things along those lines could play a bigger role as opposed to expanding our current public transportation system, which is based on models used all over the world?
Well, and there's things I've read an article this morning about in Pinellas County where they successfully are doing some outlier routes to tie into it and save money. Essentially, what they had given to do that, their subsidy was about 40-something thousand. The route that they could get rid of was 140,000. So I think there's probably some of that. If you look at the heat maps from an Uber standpoint, it's getting to be more of – and I think there's probably people taking trips that weren't taking trips before.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And did you want to
– Well, yes. On this station this morning, you all had a report about the many dozens of referendums around the country this year on mass transit funding, the highest ever apparently, and in some reasonably places where you wouldn't have thought that this would be an impetus. And the main reason is it's the affordable way to move into a much more populated future.
And if we're thinking of the same story, they were talking about a lot of, raising local tax dollars because
exactly.
They weren't getting the federal support. Okay. We're exactly. On the same page.
Right. Because it supports local economies. This
right.
is and what Tessa had to say about context. Context sensitivity is one of the things that Ian and the other presenters will be focusing on greatly in this summit that's coming up. And the context sensitivity results in a much more robust, diversified, and resilient economy. It's about your local economy supporting it and building it. And that's what a true multimodal system can do. And as Ian mentioned, because you get more business, more people, more tax revenue in the same space.
Right. And Don, are we seeing any changes in attitudes in news, at least in regards to expanding railroads and rail corridors? Is that something we should consider?
Well, we have looked at the feasibility of increasing the use of the rail corridor, but that's further off into the future. It's when you look across the nation, it's not growing at the rate you would think it would grow. But obviously, that's another mode that would be useful for moving freight, for instance, in the area, and then maybe in the future, passengers.
And looking again a bit into the future, self-driving cars are quickly becoming a reality. Just yesterday, the federal regulators announced a 15-point safety checklist they're pushing for automakers and tech companies to comply with before their autonomous cars hit the road. How does that change the game in terms of transportation and concerns here in Southwest Florida? I mean, are there any other future technologies we should be considering now that can impact transportation planning?
Well, it's definitely from one side. There's many levels of autonomous vehicles driving by itself, but there's also just the safety features that I think you're going to see a lot more of that hopefully make that safer also as we get towards that. The downside might be you've seen some things where there have been requests for separate lanes. We have a hard enough time building what we have right now. I don't see a lot of separate lanes for autonomous vehicles.
All right. Well, we are coming up to the end of our time for this segment. But, Anne, I was hoping you could just tell us a bit about the Transportation Summit, what folks need to know who are interested in participating.
All right. Gladly. First of all, I want to say our partners in this are the Royal Palm Coast Realtors Association. We work together to get a grant from the National Association of Realtors. This is a national trend, and the National Association of Realtors has been publishing on the issues of context sensitivity and multimodal and more compact, smarter growth pattern, land use patterns for years. So as the AARP, along with USDOT, EPA, HUD. So this, we've come together as partners, and the summit is all day long Thursday and half day Friday. Thursday is an 8-hour long interactive hands-on workshop that sold out once, and so we had to move it to a bigger venue, I'm now at capacity for that. And then Friday morning, we will be at the Cape Coral Yacht Club. We have plenty of room. It can hold 300. And we'll have our same national experts. And these guys are perhaps the best in the entire country on this subject. We have a very special opportunity here in Southwest Florida to learn from Ian and Dan Burden and Billy Hathaway. And then Paula Benway, the president of ITE, Institute of Transportation Engineers, will be there also. And we'll have a panel discussion with city managers on how to afford this, how to implement it. And then we'll hear from another member of the MPO and the Cape Coral Mayor Retzer, who've been attending the Leadership Academy for MPOs for the past year on the new federal performance measures. Prior to this, only throughput, numbers of vehicles moved from point A to B in X amount of time was the accountability measure, and all kinds of other measures are going to have to be accounted for, such as bicycle, pedestrian, environmental, watershed, that type of thing. So Friday morning, 8 to noon at the Cape Coral Yacht Club, and we would love to have you. You will learn a lot.
All right. Thanks so much. We've been speaking today with Don Scott with the Lee County Metropolitan Planning Organization, Tessa Lesage with the Southwest Florida Community Foundation, Ann Pierce with the nonprofit Streets Alive Southwest Florida, and by phone, Ian Lockwood, a transportation engineer who is presenting at the Regional Transportation Summit right here in Cape Coral next week. Great to speak with you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're taking a short break, and when we return, one of the wettest winters in years has severely impacted tomato growers in Florida. Coming up, what growers and others in the industry have to say about the past growing season's reduced crop yield and projections for the coming growing season. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.